This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. This is Allegro Non Troppo, broadcast locally on 3JOY and across Australia on the Community Radio Satellite Network, presented by Adam and John.
Thank you. Now, today, Allegro Non Troppo is doing a special show about first sexual experiences and looking to see if they shape the rest of your life.
Most cultures hold the first sexual experience as one of the greatest moments in a person's life.
The rite of passage into the all-knowing bliss of sexuality. Is it? Should it be so? If it isn't, what are the consequences?
If your first time is awful, does that set the tone for the rest of your life? We all know some people who think that their lives are stuffed because their first sexual experience was traumatic, vile, disgusting, boring, a debasement of human morality.
Or if it was a wonderful experience, what are the transfer effects? A, you love life, you fell in love with your first partner, you now know what beauty is, and you now know what a beauty is.
Was your first time a passage to a new existence, or was it just a route? If it was just a route, is that okay?
Some people have more than one first sexual experience. They have sex with people of different genders as well as the same.
Does anyone actually plan their first sexual experience? Is it an accident or serendipitous? What happens if it's awful?
Now, here is the real curly question. Have you ever been with someone else first?
Who was your first? How did it happen? Did it live up to expectations?
If you know you were going to be with someone first, what would do? It is a huge responsibility.
What happens to people who live heterosexual lives for a long time and then discover they desire same-sex experience? Do they burst with excitement?
What about people who have accidental same-sex experiences?
Indeed, what about them? Joining us to discuss this huge plethora of issues is somebody I'm really pleased to be able to welcome to the show, Dr. Leslie Kennold. Welcome from Melbourne University.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
And it's great to have you on air. And I have to say, I just admire the work that you've done so much for so many years. I've learnt a lot listening to you and other media.
Oh, well, thank you. That's really, really flattering.
Yeah, but you're also a highly qualified academic. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we launch into this?
Sure. I'm actually a bit in transition. So my background is that I have training as a medical ethicist, and also I have a PhD in social research. And so I've written a couple of books that are about women's experiences of, well, one's about abortion and one's about choosing to be childless, so kind of the spectrum of reproduction. But for the last few years, I've been writing a novel. So that's I'm finishing that this week, and not really sure what's going to happen after that. So I might just keep writing books, or I might go back to academia. So it's not quite clear.
How long has the book taken you to write?
I don't want to freak anyone out, but it took a very long time. I mean, I was initially attempting it while I was still working part-time as an academic, so that probably is slightly comforting. But really, all up, it's taken about 5 years, and it required me to go back to... you know, when you have a PhD, you think you're finished with education because there's just simply nothing else to do. But I actually went back to RMIT and took parts of a professional writing course in order to learn how to write a novel, because despite the fact that I could write nonfiction, it didn't mean I could write fiction. So it's been a very long journey, but I'm a terribly, terribly stubborn person. So once I had determined that I was going to finish this book, no matter what it took me, I just did whatever it took. So... We'll have to see now what happens.
Dr. Kennold, during your academic and professional career, you've dealt with a lot of really curly ethical issues, okay? Being an ethicist, of course, that's naturally. But human sexuality is probably one of the most complex yet individual things. You know, we come up with titles and pigeonholes of people as being gay, lesbian, straight, bisexual. But I just propose that that's probably a little bit of an unfair thing, because we're all so individual that sexuality really is unique to each person. There's no two people have identical or even close sexuality. Could you comment on that statement?
Well, I think you're right about that, in the sense that I think often sexuality is in a continuum, and I would have bought in when I was younger to this idea that, you know, you were one thing or another. And of course we have those binaries with with gender. You know, you're either male or female. Although, in fact, we know that there's also people who are intersex, and there's also people who are sitting in a male body but feel female, or the reverse. So, again, it is in fact quite complex. But when I was younger, I had a very good girlfriend who was straight, and I don't think she ever really thought about that. And then she fell in love with a woman. She had a relationship with a woman for a while, and she fell in love with a man. And she had a relationship with a man for a while. She went back to a woman. She was capable of falling in love just with people. And for me, that was a really formative experience, because she was a very good friend of mine. And to see the fluidity of it, because she was someone who didn't have any hang-ups about it, who wasn't buying into any of the rules about how you had to be in a box. And I really admired that about her. And that was not something that I found about myself. I found that I was much more oriented towards one sex. But it opened me up to this idea that when people are freed of all the rules, and there's so many rules about how we ought to behave sexually in terms of relationships, I mean, rules govern every aspect of our lives, but she was someone who was unusually not interested in them. And when that was possible, it was interesting to see somebody who was so comfortable and fluid and able to do what I think sounds to me like the right thing, which is not fall in love with somebody because of what their sex or gender is, but to fall in love with a person, you know, to look past that outside skin and to go within. It almost seems like what love is supposed to be about.
Let's have a look at sexuality and sexual experience. This is a really interesting topic. First, sexual experience. Now, let's ask you this question. In your opinion, in your capacity as an ethicist, how important is the first sexual, and I mean, I'm not just talking about kids playing doctor, but the actual full first experience.
Which was critical in my formative years.
Oh, was it?
It was.
Okay. I was just going to make a bad joke, but I won't. The first sexual experience, was, let's say the first like full-on to orgasm, penetration, sexual experience, how important really do you think it is in people's lives?
Well, I guess I would initially say that I'm not sure the fact that you have to orgasm would be the critical thing that would make it important. I think the first, what is important about a first experience is that you are open, that you are potentially opening yourself up emotionally, but you're also doing something unusual in terms of sex. And usually what makes it such a profound experience, either negative or positive, is that it's not just about sex. So for instance, I think if your first experience is what you were saying before, you know, it's just a route, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is, whether it was good or bad, is likely to have a profound influence on the ideas you carry forward about sex.
Mm-hmm.
But I, just because it's your first experience, in other words, I don't think that's what makes it really significant.
Mm-hmm.
You can just move on from that. But I think if you open yourself up, if you make it something that's big, so for many of us, we think about we're going to lose our virginity, you know, and we think about what that's going to be like, and we try to plan it, and we often try to orchestrate it. And I think if you invest that much in it, especially years leading up to it, whatever happens in that experience can be bad or good, quite have a big impact on the way that you think about sex and how you proceed with it going forward.
Now, the survey that I'm referring to is, we did a survey on Allegro Non Troppo a couple of months ago called Like a Virgin, where we asked our listener to respond to the survey anonymously. It's all completely anonymous, and we could take up to 100 respondents, and we got 100 answers. And the questions and the things that we asked them, I thought we might use as our basis for our discussion today. The first thing, which I found quite surprising, was the age of first sexual experience. And it seems to be that it was actually, I expected everybody to be fairly young, going by the people I know in my life, and yet there was a huge cross-section of ages. The majority of people, their sexual experience seemed to be in their mid to late teens and early 20s. But then there was another peak of people in their 30s. I'm just wondering why that would be. Why was there this sudden drop-off, and then suddenly a lot of people didn't have sex until their 30s? I couldn't find any correlation in the data. Got anything
as their first sexual experience?
Yeah.
Well, again, it might be the way you defined it. So it might be because part of what the definition was about that it had to be, I think, to orgasm. Mm. Wasn't that right?
Yes.
So it may be that people were doing lots of things, but for instance, for a woman, Maybe she just wasn't capable of reaching orgasm, and so she didn't reach orgasm until she was 30.
Ah.
But there's other reasons too. I met a very interesting bloke the other day who was involved in an evangelical kind of Christian church and had made that kind of vow about keeping pure and keeping as a virgin until one was married, saving oneself for marriage. And that's indeed what he had done for quite a long time until he left the church in his early 30s.
So our education, our background and our cultural beliefs from our family that we inherit as part of who we are can play quite a big part in this particular event.
Well, we can think we tend to think that everyone is promiscuous, that everyone is getting into sex and getting into a lot more sex at a lot of earlier ages. And certainly people in general, there has been a shift downwards in terms of when some people are having their first sexual experience. But as you said at the start, for every person, there's going to be a different story and a different reason. And lots of people either wouldn't have fit the definition or would have, for reasons that would have probably included religion and faith, mm-hmm. but probably not even exclusively. Maybe for some people they lacked confidence. Maybe for some people they weren't sure of who they desired. So you have uncertainty about gender preference and, you know, sexual preference. So that can slow people down because they might experiment a little with the one sex, but that's not meeting their needs, but they're afraid to go the other way. So they wait and they hesitate, and that it takes them a while to get there.
Let's talk a little bit about on this topic about the age of first sexual experience and the legal situation, the age of consent. I know some 15-year-olds, I'm a teacher myself, but I know some 15, 16-year-olds who I think have got enough information and enough reasoning and enough understanding of themselves and the world to be able to make informed decisions regarding sex. And I think they'd be probably, they're not likely to, but if they said to me, I'm going out and I'm having sex, I think, well, yeah, I think that's probably okay because you know what you're doing. By the same token, I know some people who are 45 who are not capable of making informed, reasonable decisions about their own sexuality. But the law says that you have to be, in loose terms, around Australia, it's different in some states, the law says you have to be 18. I think that's reasonable. What do you think?
Well, the law is a little bit more complex, isn't it? Because doesn't it have elements about how you can be younger if the person you're having sex with
that's in Victoria.
Is closer to your age? That's right.
But we're broadcasting nationally, so...
So we're going to just generalise.
Generalise, okay.
Well, look, I tend to not believe in hard and fast rules, again, for this reason that I think people are so different. And one of the interesting things that has developed over the years with regard to thinking about teenagers who are sort of in this twilight land between being children. So we know they're not really children anymore, but we also know that they're not adults. So what exactly are they? Well, we call them teenagers. But what that means in practice is that it's just as you said, that for different things, they can have different capacities to consent. And so the students you may be talking about who you would think, yeah, no question, you know, this person is perfectly capable of deciding they want to have sex and also perfectly capable of saying no, you might find that in another area of their life they aren't competent to make even the most basic decisions. So people are in and out and up and down, and I wonder really whether the law is an appropriate regulatory mechanism for sex. To me it always seems, why is the law telling us when we can and can't have sex? I mean, we know the reason why. In part, it's about, you know, the
protecting children.
It's about protecting children. And it's also, I think there's hangovers from our Christian past where there were very strict ideas about not just children having sex, but about all of us having sex and how we should be and when we should be. And these relate to laws that we've had around prohibiting homosexuality, for instance.
Yes.
I mean, there've been a lot of rules that haven't been, sometimes we couch it in terms of protecting children, but it really isn't always about that. But I'm just not 100% sure that you could weigh it out into most high schools, and I bet you nearly none of them would know about those laws.
Yes.
So I think if they are or aren't having sex, it's because other things are governing them. Their peer groups are governing them. Their parents are governing
them. Yes, they're not
them.
Sitting there, oh, well, I can't have sex because I'm under 18.
That's right, and I'm just the way they obey the law about drinking.
Yes.
So, you know, you can make the law an ass a bit,
so
if I can
put the story on the table, I was 15 for my first sexual experience. The guy would have been in his late 30s, possibly 40. The whole thing was completely prearranged. I wanted to go out and have sex with a man because I didn't know if I was gay or not, and I thought, well, the way to find out is to go and have sex with a man. And I was quite organized at 15 to go out and do it, and I, you know, think I did everything correctly, meet in the public place and not, you know, suss him out first and that sort of thing. But I mean, I didn't tell him I was 15. I lied and said I was 16 because in New Zealand at the time that was the age of consent. So I do agree with you that, you know, the law is quite funny there. Would he have, if he'd known that I was 15, would he have still met me? Or did I purposely lied?
Yes.
Thinking he's not going to meet me if I tell him the truth and say I'm 15.
It's sticky, isn't it? Because, of course, the law can't do exactly what we're saying is necessary, which is adjust to each individual. Mm. So I take your word for it that you were completely competent and capable of making the decisions that you were making. But the law has to do a one-size-fits-all. And it is, I think, there is an element of it that's trying to protect people and also trying to warn adults. And some adults don't get this, that teenagers are these twilight creatures that you have to be particularly careful about with regard to their competency to consent. So you can't just assume, as you may wrongly do, but we do, that if you're over 18, you're definitely an adult, you can take responsibility for yourself. I don't need to play your side of the fence. I can just look after my own rights and do what I need to do, and I can assume you can do the same for yourself. But with children, we have different obligations, don't we, as adults? We need to be looking out for them as well. We need to recognize that they aren't completely capable of negotiating things necessarily for themselves at all times. So maybe he would have, and if he wouldn't have, he should have, if he knew how old you were. He might have asked more questions. He might have needed to have felt around a little bit more. I'm talking morals here, not the law. The law, he would have been on the wrong side of it.
Do you think, obviously, a lot of same-sex attracted people who have that attraction wait till later in life before trying? I don't know, you know, my partner waited until he was in his 40s before he actually had that first same-sex experience. But do you think, on the other side of that, that a lot of people that are same-sex attracted may start at a younger age than...
It's hard to tell, really.
I think it's really hard to tell, and I've never seen any data about it.
This leads into our second question that we did on the survey, which was... thinking of your first sexual experience, did you plan it or was it unexpected? Because I was just interested to know how many people think, okay, I want to go and have sex. And do they make it an event and they plan and prepare? I think my first sexual experience was very planned over several weeks. It was very calculated. I'd even written up what I was going to do. But that's me. I had. But if you actually knew what it was, you wouldn't be laughing, let me tell you. I'm an evil boy.
Hey? My first one, completely planned. I knew that I needed to have sex with a guy to see if I was gay.
Mm.
And I was 15 at the time, and I did it. And I did it three times just to make sure that I actually enjoyed it. And then I didn't do anything for 2 years because I thought at the time I'm too young to be sexually active. I've done what I needed to do.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And so I stopped until I was 17 and met a partner.
Let's explore this, because here's the response we had from our listeners who completed the survey. 31% of our listeners planned their first sexual experience, the people who did the survey. 23% planned it, but it happened sooner than they expected. So they were with somebody and they thought, you know, it's eventually going to happen, but it happened a lot quicker. They obviously couldn't control it. 28% weren't expecting to have sex. So their first sexual experience was unplanned. 7% didn't realise they were having sex until after the event. And there's 13% weren't expecting to have sex at all. It just suddenly happened. Now, the interesting point is the 28% that were not expecting to have sex, judging through the comments that I read, and one of the things I've discussed a couple of times with Dr. Kennold coming onto this show, which really surprised me, were the number of people who weren't planning to have sex, and 3% of the people in the survey were raped, and 6% were molested, judging by the comments. Now, that absolutely horrified me, Dr. Kennold, to think that 3% of the people... So that transcribes, if we were to put this onto a wider demographic across our cultural community here, we'd say almost 10% of the people have sex. It's not because they want to, it's because they're molested or raped.
Well, we'd have to be careful not to do that. So in other words, it may be the case that you could take these findings and put them over the broader population of the community that listens to your radio station. But even that's just a segment of the community.
That's right.
But this is what's called a self-selected sample. So this is people who've chosen, for whatever their reasons, and we don't know what those reasons are, to answer this survey. And it may be that more people who have had this experience want to answer the survey. And so you could be getting a misunderstanding. Having said all that, there are certainly people who... their first experience is not a consensual one. I was one of them, so I definitely know it happens. And you know, it's, I think it's important that, I think what was interesting about your survey is that I'm not, you didn't expect it. And so the question, you didn't offer that as a response. And I think what was interesting is that then people took that option that was the coded response, which was, I wasn't expecting it, or whatever the wording was. And they then wanted to explain to you why it was they weren't expecting it. Mm. They weren't expecting it because they didn't choose it. And that's not what they wanted. And look, you know, that is a first experience. I think it's inarguable that being assaulted, no matter when you're being assaulted, first, second, 20th experience or 100th, is not pleasant. But I do think that when it's your first experience, you do end up missing out on the fun of the kind of conversations that we're having now, because often you can have quite a lot of fun sitting around some beers, everybody telling great stories about their first time, and usually there's some terribly embarrassing thing that's happened, and, you know, there's all sorts of funny, amusing mishaps. So I think for me, the saddest thing about not having been consenting to my first experience is that I always feel terribly left out of those conversations. But I don't feel like it's, you know, scarred me for life. I feel like I was able to move on from it.
That's the important, and that's the whole crux of this whole thing that we're doing. I just wanted to point out, I had quite a bit of criticism from people doing the survey that they didn't think the questions I did led to particularly good set of data. But I wasn't doing an academic survey. I'm doing a survey to create an hour of interesting radio. Okay. If I was doing an academic survey, the questions would have been a lot different. But it was interesting. Now, this first sexual experience, if it's a non-consensual situation, this was part of the thing I wanted to discover. Does it scar you for the rest of your life? Now, in your case, obviously, you've just said that it didn't. And I just wonder about the other listener. I have no data on this survey to be able to confirm or deny that. But from your professional experience, if the first time is non-consensual, is it a really significant event in people's lives? Do they get over it?
I think being assaulted, you know, so whatever version of sexual assault we're talking about, being in a sexual situation where you're not consenting and you didn't consent can in and of itself be a difficult experience. And I don't think what's critical about how you then go on to manage it successfully or not is whether it was your first time. Mm. I think it's unpleasant that it's your first time. It kind of adds a little extra ick factor. But I think the main ick of it is that you were assaulted, and that raises huge issues for people, because the central issue for all of us in our lives is to feel in control. Okay. So what we know, and this goes across what a much wider area than sexual issues, if you do any study and you find unhappy people, nearly always the cause of a part of why they're unhappy, whether it's at an office, wherever it is they're not feeling in control of their lives. They're feeling like other people get to tell them what to do and when to do it, and they feel completely at the mercy of others. So when you then take that back to a sexual assault experience, that's the quintessential, that's the essence of it. You've lost control. Okay. You weren't able to say what you wanted to do and when you wanted to do it, and that spins people out emotionally. And it can be a growing experience, like all negative experiences. What doesn't kill us makes us strong. Nothing's different here. So some people can really grow from that. They can think about how it happened. They can think about what was awful about it for them. They can think about how they're going to, you know, protect themselves in the future, and they can move on from it. And other people, and again, this is for all experiences in life, a negative experience can floor you, and sometimes you don't get up again. You let it, you know, define who you are. You let it define everything about
exactly.
Your life is going to be going forward.
And I think all of us can relate to people we know where that's been the case. It's great to be able to rationalize a situation, a really traumatic situation in your life that has caused you trauma. If you can sit down and rationalize it, but not a lot of people can, that's when you really need to go and get help.
Absolutely.
Going to see a counselor or a psychologist is a fantastic way to overcome and address these issues. But the other thing is, don't end up relying. I know I've got quite a few friends who see psychologists, counselors, and they've been doing it for years and years. Mm. You know, just at some stage, you have to be able to try and resolve. And I just feel so sorry for those people who cannot resolve certain issues and move forward. Just wanted to touch on something else to do with this non-consensual thing. It does go the other way. I teach primary school for a very good reason. I taught high school for a while, and we were discussing earlier whether people can pick up on somebody being gay or not. Okay, I quite obviously must look gay, because a number of schoolboys that made it obvious that they wanted to do something made me terribly uncomfortable. And I thought, I could probably deal with this, a strategy of sort of, go away, don't do this. And I thought, no, I don't want to give them the nickname. So I stopped teaching high school for that very reason. It only happened about four or five times where I had some of these kids literally throwing themselves at me. And I thought, the only way this is going to resolve for me, where I'm not going to feel bad about giving them this really negative rejection,
which you had to do,
which I had to do,
because you had power over them, and there was no question. Issues and everything
And even those that came out to me, not for physical expression, but came to me and said, "I think I'm gay," I couldn't be involved in that process either.
The coming out process.
No, absolutely not. What happens is this: you have a kid at school, right? They come to me and they say, "Mr. Stobbs, I think I'm gay." Okay. And I talk to them and say, look, you can go get information from this place, that and the other. And then they come out to their family and they say, well, you know, who talked to you? Who had some influence about coming out? Oh, when I was at school, Mr. Stobbs was there to tell me and do what to do. The parents do not take that issue very well. Now, I've never had an issue. I've had, in my early years, I did help a couple of kids with information and pointed them in the right direction. And on one occasion, their parents contacted me and I said, yes, this is what you need to do for your child. Okay, but I recognised that that was a situation I didn't want to be in, and it wouldn't always work out well, because not everybody turns out to be okay with their sexuality or their families, and I didn't want to be put myself in a situation where I had to. So I thought easiest thing for me is not to teach kids in that age group. And
it's a bit sad though, isn't it? Because of
but
course,
can you see the rationale?
I completely see the rationale, but I just feel sad that that's what you felt and it was necessary, because I'm sure that we know that people who are unsure about their sexuality in high school really, really suffer. And we know that the depression rates and the suicide rates are really high amongst people who are lesbian and gay and bisexual. So I would have thought that if it was otherwise, you would be a wonderful chance for kids to see that there are, you know, because often gay and lesbian young people feel that they're alone. They feel like they're the only people who are gay and lesbian. No one ever has been before, and no one will ever be since, because it's invisible. It's made invisible in their lives. So I just think it would be an opportunity, were it to be different, where they could see someone who is out and proud and doing just like everyone else, and the only difference was the people they choose to love was the same sex.
Yes, bit of a shame that it's not that
really
way.
It is really just a shame, yeah.
Our special guest on Allegro Non-Troppo on the Community Radio Network today is Dr. Leslie Cannold from Melbourne University, although you're not quite here in that capacity.
I'm just here as a general wise woman.
You certainly are. This is Allegro Non-Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. We'd like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for funding Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network. A special guest on Allegro today on the Community Radio Network is Dr. Leslie Cannold. We're doing our Like a Virgin show, which is based on the survey that we did on Allegro Non Troppo on our website over a period of months. And we're going through the data that we've collected and looking at the responses and looking to see how first sexual experiences translate in the rest of our other life experiences. We were talking about the age of you and your first partner. We're just looking at some of the data that we've got. And I was quite amazed. I assumed that most people, when they have sex with somebody who's a fair bit older. And they go for somebody with a bit of experience, but not according to the data. 48% of the respondents to our survey had sex for the first time with somebody who was the same age.
Oh, that's just, you know, location, 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 isn't it?
Is it?
Oh, I mean, you know, who are the people we most have contact with and are able to form the kind of sexual attraction or emotional intimacy? They're people who usually are in our same year at school.
Who we're hanging out with.
Yeah, we're hanging out with. That's right. They tend to be our age.
But what also was interesting was the people who had sex with people who were a lot older. And up to 10% of people had sex with somebody who was significantly older. Yet, on the other hand, there's not very many people. There's only one person out of the hundred who had sex with somebody for the first time who was a lot younger. So it's just interesting to look at how the age thing actually pans out. So most people seem to have sex with somebody around about the same age, and a reasonable percentage have sex with people who are a bit older. But not many people have sex for the first time with somebody who's a lot younger. That's almost non-existent. I suppose that would be fairly conclusive, I think. We don't need to discuss much a little bit about that. Now, how long did you know your first partner before you had sex? And this was really interesting because it panned out almost equally. A third of the people who had sex for the first time also met the person for the first time. So here's this, I had this illusion that everybody would know somebody for a while before they had sex with them, but a lot of people almost seemed their first sexual experience was anonymous. Dr. Kennell, is this true across all sections of society?
I'm not actually really sure, you know, whether that's a common experience or not, but I think it's interesting because I think it tells us that, again, you know, not everybody approaches the situation in the same way. And now you may have some people wrapped up in that figure who didn't plan it because they didn't consent to it. So what happened to them that night was not something that they had chosen. But I still think you're going to be left with, given the relatively small figures we had of people who were talking about non-consensual sex, the majority are talking about people who chose it. So either, there's two ways of understanding that. Either people were thinking, well, I want to go out tonight and want to lose my virginity, you know, and I don't think it's like that big a deal in the sense that it has to be anything more than tonight's the night. This is what I want to do. And they go out and they pick somebody up and that's what they have happen. And the other option is that they're not planning it, but an opportunity comes along and they think, I'm however old I am and I'm in this place in my life and this seems like a good idea. Why shouldn't I do it? But again, to me, that speaks of this idea that people aren't over thinking about it. They aren't thinking, you know, it's my first experience. It has to be on a beach. We have to have, you know, this sort of
candlelight and romantic music.
It has to be sunny.
Yes.
You know, whereas there are some people, and I certainly grew up with a few girls who I feel were fated for disappointment because you can't plan with that level of minutiae and not end up having the situation fail to match the fantasy. And then that's a cause for disappointment in and of itself, whatever the actual experience was.
Do you think that's the fault of popular culture?
Oh, it is so, you know, part of, again, this build-up that the first time has to be so special and the first time, you know, with the implication that somehow if it's not, you are a failure, the relationship is going to be a failure, or the sex you have in the future going forward is going to fail. Whereas where are the necessary connections between these things? I mean, they don't connect in life. You can have a bad first day at school and go on to be very successful in academia. You can have a terrible first job and go on to enjoy work later on. We don't make that assumption in practically any other area of our life. And yet here, you know, there is this much bigger set of expectations. Okay. And I think partially what people are trying to control by controlling the first sexual experience, and we're seeing this with the evangelical Christian movement, with this idea that people should be virgins when they get married, really they're trying to control anxiety about relationships. So they're trying to say, if I can control this one interaction, my first sexual experience, X hours, you know, one day in my life, and make it perfect, that means that this relationship will be perfect. We won't get divorced. We won't fight. Nothing will go wrong. And that's just silly. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could do that, if you could make that direct connection? And
yes.
But it's not the truth.
Let me put this into another context. We had a person in here from America a few months ago called Chichi LaRue, who makes a lot of porn, gay porn. And I put him I did a cross-examination, interrogation, and passed judgment on this person because I said, you know, you create all this fantastic porn and it just puts unreasonable expectations of what sex is actually really going to be like. I mean, pornographic movies go for hours and hours. They go for months of planning and they shoot little scenes, but then you sort of see it. I don't know if you've seen any, but you see it in this sort of like this little 10, 15-minute snapshot and you think, well, gives you this idea, if I'm not having sex like that, then my sex life is not worthwhile. And it's a bit like popular culture. It puts unreasonable expectations into people's minds of what it's going to be like.
And I think we saw this a bit with the Sex and the City phenomenon.
Yes.
Is that all of a sudden people got this idea that because these four girls on TV, all of whom were actresses, were having sex the way that they were, which was this wild kind of, you know, every night a different man and each one hunkier than the next. And we were hanging from ceilings, we were swinging from floors. You know, there was nothing that these women weren't doing, that the rest of us were somehow missing out on this life that was existing out there. And we were all failures. And more than that, it wasn't wasn't just that we were missing out on sex, but that sex in that program was kind of what life was about. It was all about, you know, this kind of sex was the thing that gave your life pizzazz and meaning. So you weren't just missing out on a good route, you were missing out on kind of having the kind of life that in this modern day and age we all should be aspiring to. And I think, again, that's overblowing sex. You know, you can make anything too big. Life is rich and diverse, and there's so many different parts of it that can be meaningful and fulfilling. We all have parts of our lives that are not particularly perfect in at one point, or maybe all through them. But that doesn't mean the rest of our life is, you know, not worth living.
Good theory.
Oh, you like that one?
It's a good theory. How realistic it is in our lives, I don't know. Because there's an interchange as well. You might not have a good sex life at a particular time in your life, but other things might be going really well. Your career might be going well. But because of the way popular culture orchestrates into our lives, sex just seems to be in everything. You know, it's everything. I mean, all advertising, television shows, everything. Even if it's not the first thing, it's the undercurrent, the sexual undercurrent, and the subtext is there. And the message is, if you're not having a good, happy sex life, your life's not good. And that's
sex
not necessary.
And being sexy.
Yes.
Sex and being hot. So I just want to repeat to you, for amusement's sake, really, only I'm not sure there's a great deeper point to this, but my grade 9 child went off the other day to his first social. And he came back and he'd had a fantastic time. And he repeated to me a conversation that had happened with this girl who he ended up hooking up with. And there was a lot of hooking up going on at this social, lots of kissing going on between the boys and this 5 different girls' schools that had descended on this one boys' school. I know, it's fascinating. This is the conversation that went on the dance floor. They're all dancing around. And she looks at him and she goes, "Hi, you're hot." And he goes, "Oh, thanks." And she says, "Do you have dark hair? Is your hair like dark? I can't quite kind of see in this light." "Yeah." "Oh, that's hot. What's that T-shirt? Oh, right. That's hot." This just went on and on. She basically dissected everything he was wearing, and it was all hot. So I said to him at the end of this conversation, great conversationalist she was there, but he was delighted because he had passed whatever the sort of litmus test was in terms of being desirable and of interest and worthy of being someone's boyfriend.
Reinforcement.
He was hot.
Reinforcement of self-image and ego.
He was hot.
I think mission accomplished. That's what it's all about, isn't it, really? If you think of a year 9 social.
And that's all. And in that venue, I can see why you're not going to get into anything deeper and more meaningful. But I do think there is a translation there into this idea that kids think, all I need to do these days is be hot. Because if I'm hot, maybe I can get on TV. And if I'm on TV, I can be famous. And that's really what life and meaning is all about. So it's all very on the surface. And it very much takes, as you say, the notion of sex and sexy and then transports it into a life worth living. Mm. And I just don't think there is that easy movement between those two things.
And one of the things we should be doing, I think, as educators and parents and responsible people in society is actually making kids aware you don't have to be hot to be good.
Well, that's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. But you don't have to be hot to be good.
We're failing miserably because popular culture just seems to reinforce and then reinforce what it's reinforced. It's all about the same thing. And that's why we get so many kids grow up and they just become completely obsessed with things they don't really need to be obsessed about. I would like to say, though, that our listeners who filled in the survey said that their first sexual experience was a life-changing wonder, a great experience, good and positive. And that counts for 75% of the people.
Isn't that heartening?
Yeah, it's good. But then there was about another 20% or so said that it wasn't so brilliant.
But see, to me, I look at that question and I think my first job was, you know, and you'd pretty much get, I reckon,
the same response. Yeah.
Same breakdown. I mean, that's life. Every experience has its, you know, ups and downs for different ones of us.
One of the things that we, in part of our education and culture, particularly if we went to a religious education, is that the first person you have sex with, you must be in love with. Mm. You can't have sex until you're in love. It used to be married, but I think there's been a little bit of a moderation of that sort of Puritan attribute. But it's quite interesting because the vast majority of the people who responded to our survey were in no way in love or had any emotional connection with the person they had sex with for the first time.
And I think that's so interesting, and there could be so many reasons. You know, this is the wonderful thing about, you know, questionnaires is you get these kind of neat numbers, but I desperately, desperately want to pick apart that, you know, yes, were you not, were you in love with them, not in love with them because you didn't even know them? Were you not, you know, so it was one of those one-night stand situations, or were you not in love with them because you are now such a mature, developed, self-realized person that you recognize that at the age of 16 or 17, you had no idea what love was. And therefore, you know, you may have thought you were in love with them, but now you know, looking back, that that simply wasn't possible. And you could have, you know, both of those things wrapped up in there and probably everything in between. But I do think that, you know, it's good in a way that we have been able to separate love and sex. It creates complications for us. It creates complexities, but it is.
You've just made a very interesting statement. I'm going to take you to task over. It's good that we've been able to separate love and sex. Whenever I say this, I get shot down in flames.
Do you?
Oh, incredibly. By who? Just about everybody, because I perfectly, absolutely think it's great. It's good to have sex and love together, but it's good to be able to also separate them. And then sex just becomes a physical activity. So, yeah, good.
I guess, just to be a bit clearer about it, is I think that should be an option in the array of things that we are able to be offered in this life without being judged negatively for it. So, as you rightly pointed out, we have really just come out of thousands and thousands of years where there were incredibly strict rules about how everything needed to be zipped up and sewn up tight. You needed to love the person you were having sex with. You could only have sex with the person you were married to. And you could only be married to one person, and that had to be for life. So now we have split open a lot of these things, and we can even split open, you know, sex and reproduction. These things can now be separate too because of things like IVF. So with all of that fracturing, people can still choose to keep all those things compacted if they want. They can still say to themselves, I want to be the kind of person who only has sex with the person I'm in love with, only is in love with the person I'm going to marry, only has sex with the person I'm going to marry, and only does it in the missionary position. Good on them. Let them do that.
Yes.
I have no problem with it. You need to judge for yourself what is going to make you happy and what's right for you. But why shouldn't, on the other hand, someone else say, I want to have a more, you know, diverse experience. I want to have sex with lots of people before I commit to someone. I may just want to commit to someone during the years that we raise children together, and then I may want to have other serious monogamous relationships, or I may never want to be in a monogamous relationship again. I may want to love people, but I find it too complicated when I love them and also have sex with them. It seems to make it too messy for me. I want to split those things up. Why shouldn't that option be available to people who think that's what's going to give them a meaningful life?
It is to me, let me tell you. I like to think that I've got a fairly mature approach, and I know quite a number of gay and lesbian people who do have a mature approach to their sexuality. I have a partner, and we've been together for quite a number of years, but we have sex with other people, and that does not in any way impact on our relationship. I like to think we've got a fairly mature, that we can identify sex and love as being separate, bring them together when necessary, but also not have them together and separate them so that we can still have a really fulfilling life. Now, you know how many heterosexual people have a huge problem with that?
But see, what's interesting...
You're cheating. Yeah. I'm not cheating.
But what's interesting to me about that is if you go back to where that notion of cheating came from, it came from the idea that, you know, we didn't imagine homosexual sex. That wasn't what we were thinking about. We were always thinking sex was heterosexual. Heterosexual sex had the opportunity of resulting in pregnancy up until relatively recently.
That's true.
So that meant that there needed to be more rules around it because we couldn't necessarily control the consequences. So fidelity was very much also about controlling childbearing. Gay sex doesn't include necessarily childbearing. You know, it can, but you have to do stuff about it. It doesn't just happen as an unintended consequence. So, of course, the gay community were the first people to start exploring this idea that you can be in love without being faithful. And fidelity wasn't necessarily a part of a committed relationship. You could be emotionally committed, but sexually more adventurous.
Has there been a migration and transfer effect from this in the gay community to the wider community? You'd probably be in a better position to be able to tell.
My guess would be yes, but I think it's coming from a number of directions because, of course, the other huge explosive event has been the contraceptive pill.
Yes.
And much more reliable contraception, because that also has allowed straight people to start separating sex from procreation. And that immediately opens up the possibility, even though we try to contain it, that you can have sex with a certain person that you want to have children with, but you also can go off and have sex with other people and not necessarily have to end up pregnant.
Can I ask you a quick side question? Nothing
sure.
to do with our interview about contraception. I don't like... I have a particular issue with the fact that it's women who have to take contraception. I think that's massively unfair.
Mm.
And I think it needs to be a shared responsibility across both genders.
I do too, but we're very far away from that. And you know one of the reasons we're far away from it is that there is still this idea about good girls and sluts, and good girls can't be seen to be prepared for sex. So you can have sex only if you've kind of, you know, fallen, you were really drunk. But if you whip out a condom and, you know, that shows you were thinking possibly of having sex, those ideas are still around.
Very good point.
Because women ultimately bear the responsibility of sex isn't protected, they are the ones who get pregnant. A guy can literally not even know that the woman's pregnant because of that, and because of the fact that women still really are not feeling comfortable to say, I choose to have sex. We're still a fair way away from, you know, that sort of change.
One of the other questions I asked our respondents to the survey is, have you been anybody else's partner when it was their first time? And to see how many people, you know, I think that's a huge responsibility. I have. And people have said, you know, this is my first time. And that completely terrified me because I thought, oh, my God, they have put me in this position of huge responsibility that I'm going to be their first time. I am obliged to make it wonderful for them and not about me. So quite a selfish attitude.
But I guess, I can't help but go to the parallel situation. I wonder how many bosses look at their first employees for whom, you know, they've just come out of uni and this is their first job. I hope some of them do think, this is this person's first job. I have a huge responsibility to make it a positive experience. But I think, you know, probably not a lot, because they probably understand this person's going to have a lot of jobs in their life. And it would be good if this first one was terrific, yeah. But it's not going to be a defining moment. And I think you can say the same thing about sex. You know, that it's good that you took it seriously. We should always try and pleasure the other person in our sexual relationships. But I think, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. This person's going to have a lot of sexual experiences. And even if the one he has with you is not the best ever, even if it's just they're going to survive and move on.
Mind you, there have been, reading the comments left by respondents, there were some that did have they were the first sexual experience, but they didn't find out till after the event or during the event. They suddenly realised, I think this person's ever done this before.
And I think that can be special. I mean, it's an honour. I would think you'd feel honoured that someone would say, this is probably, all things being equal, likely to be something I remember. And I've chosen you because I trust that you're going to try and make it something that I will remember and remember in a good way.
Dr. Kenold, it's been great to have you here on Allegra Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network, sharing this like a virgin special with us here. Just the things that we've discovered from our conversations today is that sex is an important part of your life. But the one thing I will take away, and remember that you've drawn out very carefully and very clearly, it's not the only part of life. It's just a small part. If you make it into a bigger part of your life, then be prepared for the consequences if you do. Dr. Kenold, could you give us a message to the community, please?
Well, I think in some ways I'd just like to build on that. I mean, I think people can often feel that sex is terribly important and a defining part of their life, and if it the first experience needs to be good or the rest of their sexual life is going to be terrible. And I feel that that's not really the case. I feel like we choose what life experiences are going to be like for us. We define them in our heads. So if people have had terrible experiences, I do think they should go and get some counselling, just as you suggest, and that's going to help them turn it around in their head and make them realise that was one experience in a long life. And they can turn it around. They can make it different.
Dr. Kenold, thank you very much for being on Allegro Non Troppo. Thank you, John. We'll be back next week with another Allegro. Bye, everyone.